Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a discussion with Boston Ballet Artistic Director Mikko Niisinen, sponsored by the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center as part of its Student Enrichment Series. Mikko Niisinen is recognized internationally as an accomplished dancer, teacher, and artistic director. Born in Helsinki, Niisinen began his dance training at age 10 and by age 15 had launched his dance career. Niisinen went on to dance with Dutch National Ballet, Basel Ballet, and San Francisco Ballet, where he held the position of principal dancer for 10 years. He assumed the position of artistic director of Boston Ballet and the Boston Ballet Center for Dance Education in September of 2001. Leading tonight's discussion is Professor Bruce Redford, director of the University Professors Program, and Aparna Sandhor, artistic director of the Navarasa Dance Theater. We begin with a greeting from Vita Palladino, Managing Director of the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center.
I am so happy to have this collaborative evening with the Boston Ballet, and I'm very appreciative of all their efforts to coming to Boston University and presenting to us Invitation to the Dance. Dance is the world that culminates many of the arts. It's physics, it's sports, it's painting, it's expression. It is acting, and it brings together the word, the music, the art of the design and of the costumes. And what our goal tonight is to bring to you a chance to explore where is dance going, where have we come, and where are we going? And in particular, what is happening now with the Boston Ballet with our new artistic director. I don't want to give you the introductions because they're in the program book, and I don't want to steal any minutes from this wonderful program. I am going to call out now our cast, so to speak. We will have Professor Bruce Redford, who is director of the University Professors Program. Our graduate student, Aparna Sandhor. And our guest of honor, the artistic director of the Boston Ballet, Mikko Niisinen. Enjoy the program.
I'd like to begin by asking a little bit about your own background and how you came to Boston Ballet.
Well, that took place in 2001. At that time, Alberta Ballet in Calgary, Canada. And I got a call a couple days before my vacation. I was asked to come to interview into the process of in a search of an artistic director. And I came for an interview and had an interesting time, came a second time and got the job. 5 days before the 9/11, I started, and it was a different world after that.
What was it about your training and experience, do you think, that convinced Boston Ballet that you were the appropriate person?
I would think that it was the balance, since I'm originally Finnish. I started my early training in Finland, trained in Russia, danced 10 years professionally in Europe with different companies, and then in 1987 came to America. I joined San Francisco Ballet, did a 10 years dancing there. I think the balance that I was insider in American dance, yet what I was before that insider in European dance, that sort of a combination of like two worlds, because I think today's world is more and more global, and my background was very much in a classical ballet. My interest was very much where the dance is today and the sort of contemporary works at the same time, and I think I convinced the board that that was the kind of mix that would engage really well with the Boston.
I notice from your programming that you're committed simultaneously to the contemporary repertoire, to commissioning new works, and also to the classical repertoire. How do you see these two aspects of your programming interrelating?
I think they create very interesting balance. More than anything, I'm committed really to quality. I think the most important thing is quality, quality, and quality. Dance as an art form has tremendous history. I think we have to respect preserve and show some of those works to today's audiences. We have to live very strongly in today, in now, and then we have to create works, new works, because they're new creations. In a way, they are for tomorrow. So I see it really as a three-part accent on really being here right and now, looking forward. At the same time, how can you look at the future if you don't know where you come from? It really gives you lots of information, and it's fascinating. I'm a sort of a dance history buff. I find it so interesting.
So you're creating a canon for the future, in effect, by taking a calculated risk on new works and hoping that they will permanently enrich the future of dance.
Absolutely. You just said it. The key word is calculated risk, because it's basically managing a risk. You putting a team together to create a new piece of art, you don't know what you're going to end up with. But if you know the choreographer, you know they work, you know the lighting designers, and then you sort of you know a little bit what is going to happen. You don't want to control it, because it's that chemistry that makes things really special. But I think it's vital. It's super interesting for the artists who are part of this kind of process. And it's interesting for the audiences. Today's world is changing faster than ever. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if we want to be relevant as an art form, we have to do the same.
Mm-hmm. Apon and I were talking last week a little bit about the specificity of Georges Balanchine's choreography, the way he made his dancers for and, in effect, on as very specific people, and therefore the difficulty of keeping up the Balanchine tradition when the dancers for whom he first created these works have gone. Mm-hmm. What about the style and structure and core of the Boston Ballet?
Well, I would say that the accent, since we are a major classical ballet company in the world, so we do represent, we present these big ballets, Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty. We try to do them really relevant and so that they will look fresh today. But the accent in the repertoire is really on the neoclassical ballet, which is exactly sort mm-hmm. of a Balanchine. Because after you see what he did, you can't not see anymore. And you can't go back. He opened certain things, so it's obvious. And actually, there's even that has developed further. William Forsythe has done several works that the people in Frankfurt, the insider, call the Forsythe's Balanchine ballets, because he took the Balanchine technique and sort of chopped it into pieces and put it together in a different way and gave it a bend. Balanchine was asked about story ballets and abstract ballets, and with his very nasal voice, he gave an explanation. He said, well, you have a man on stage, and you have a woman on stage, and the man extends a hand, and the woman places her hand in his hand. There's a story. What else do you need? So, in a way, a story ballet is a ballet where you go and you read in a program notes, this is what is going to happen, and you know they will live happily ever after, if that's the story. Abstract ballet, you get to make the story. Whatever it brings out in you, emotions, flashbacks. So in a way, there's a story in everything, except you become part of the creation in a sense. It is your experience. There's not right way. There's not wrong way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people say, well, when I come to the ballet, you know, I don't really know too much. And they think that that's sort of that they shouldn't come because they don't know. Mm-hmm. And I often tell, just go, be open. It tells you whatever it will. And you know what? Sometimes if it doesn't connect, often the problem is not you, the problem is on the other side of the stage. You know, so it's not so often if something doesn't connect, it doesn't mean that the individual is not able to relate. Sometimes you know, it's a live performing art. The magic is not turned on and every night it's exactly the same, but that's the fascinating thing. It's almost like the dancers go to the edge, and the process is always very interesting. Yeah, occasionally everything clicks and it's heightened to the level, but as long as the works that you present are quality, it's always interesting, and naturally company standard. Mm-hmm. You know the fluctuation is going to be here. It's not going to be suddenly.
We've mentioned Georges Balanchine. Are there other 20th century choreographers who have been influential on you?
Oh, so many of them. Being a dancer in a classical ballet company, one of the most interesting things was for me personally to dance the petit pas ballets, the classics, then work on the Balanchine works, then have some contemporary choreographer create pieces for you. That was the interesting, so that you could actually change the styles and different experience. And it's an exploration. You are so enriched when you come through this process. Every creative process leaves imprint in you, and you sort of changed. And of course, Balanchine was super important for classical ballet. Personally, sometimes I think that because he was educated in St. Petersburg and very sort of a traditional schooling at the Mariinsky, very thorough schooling. He was a musician. He was a fantastic pianist, super musical. Then he emigrated to the America, and it took him a while before he got a really foothold here. Initially, he came to Hartford and started a ballet school there and was run out of town by the other vicious ballet school. And then went to New York and tried, and it didn't quite work. And tried again, same thing. Little by little, eventually formed New York City Ballet, and the rest is sort of history. But why Balanchine today for ballet company? A, it's so interesting and important from the musical education point for the dancers. You don't have to dance on the music. You have to become yet an extra instrument on the music. So you have to be super sensitive to the music, and that's what I want my dancers to be. So it's a great tool. To do Balanchine ballets keeps your dancers very sharp from the musical point of view. The other thing, they are hard. They're super hard for the ladies on point. When you do Balanchine ballets, your company's going to be a good company.
As a teacher myself, I'm very interested in the relationship between what you might call technique on the one hand and creativity or imagination on the other. You just suggested that Balanchine presupposes a certain kind of classical training, the kind of training that he himself had. What do you think is the best training for a contemporary ballet dancer? Is it a similar kind of mixture of Russian classical training and something more contemporary?
I think in today's world, I don't anymore refer to Russian, the French. I put it simpler. Good and not so good. If you have a quality training, that's also always a great foundation. As in so many chandras of education, if you have really profound, super detailed education, it takes a very strong individual to put that aside and be truly free and creative. So the balance between, you have to have a good background.
What does that mean exactly, a good background?
You have to have a serious dance education that your body is ready and capable. You are really a pliable tool for the choreographer, because that's what it is about. The dancer is a tool for the choreographer. They have to be very open. They have to be so strong as individuals that they can be vulnerable, because it is a very honest process. And actually, in this second excerpt tonight, you will see some of that honesty that is really required from the fine artists.
What criteria do you look for when you consider dancers for the Boston Ballet? What skills, what background?
I want dancers who are very serious about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to waste anybody's time. Don't want to waste my time. I'm super serious about what I do. I've dedicated my life for this. And I'm here serving Terpsichore, the goddess of dance, and serving the community of the Boston, the education of the mecca of education in the world. The city and the community knows arts very well, and I want to deliver the finest possible company that we can. So I look for dancers who are strong technically, dancers who are musical, and who are willing to take that journey, who are open. You know, like very recently, I talked to one choreographer, and she said, oh, you know, too bad that dancer is very talented, but you know, every time I give a correction, there's this conversation. I don't want to negotiate corrections. I just want to give them and let's move on so we can achieve a little bit more. So open people, focused people. I love my dancers. It's really, I care about them a lot, and I find that I'm very privileged to be able to work with a bunch of so talented, young, beautiful human beings.
And pliable and obedient. What about the structure of the company? Do you have a tiered system whereby a dancer can rise through the ranks?
Yes. I mean, basically, we have Boston Ballet 2. Then we have a rank called Quarter Ballet, second soloist, soloist, and a principals. But I'm using the ranks a little bit differently. Let's say in Paris Opera, you're a certain rank. These roles go always for that rank. Mm-hmm. The company pretty much auditions for every single piece. Whoever is the best dancer for that role at that moment is going to dance it. So there's opportunity. You know, there's going to be a second-year quarter ballet girl doing a lead in La Sylphide because she is perfect for the part, along with the three other principal ladies. Mm-hmm. So it's an opportunity. It's healthy competition. Mm-hmm. It's never going to be stale that way. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the format within that I worked at the San Francisco Ballet. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you're not used to working in it, first it seems a little, well, why do I have to? But you know, that little fire keeps people really honest mm-hmm. and produces the best result. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Terpsichore asks mm-hmm. from me.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the relationship between what you might describe as your commercial concerns. You have to remain viable as a money-making enterprise, uh-huh. and your devotion to Terpsichore, your higher calling.
Yeah,
it must be difficult at times to negotiate the imperatives of the box office on the one hand and your creative principles and priorities on the other. Could we talk about the programming of any given season?
Mm-hmm.
The mix, I take it, that's quite calculated of standard repertoire that you assume will be commercially successful, mm-hmm. the Swan Lakes and so forth, mm-hmm. and the more innovative yeah. choreography.
Of course, the way the season is structured, I don't put anything on stage that I cannot personally stand behind and be proud of. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, to come into the theater and watch that with thousands of people, I'm in charge. I can't do it. Mm-hmm. So I stand behind everything that we do. Every year, we will present the one big, big ballet that will have a name recognition. And there's really four ballets in that category. Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, Romeo and Juliet, Cinderella. That's about it. You're going to see one of those ballets every 4 years. Which version of those, it's another story, and we're focusing how we're doing them. Besides that, currently there's several big ballets and mixed evenings. Mm-hmm. I'm playing around with it. Next year you will notice some of these mixed bills will be performed for 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and some of these bigger ballets will be performed only for 1 week. That's when I'm like a kid in a candy store. I love to put programs together and present brand new choreographers like Yorma Ello, David Dawson, who have never done anything in America, because I think that they're brilliant choreographers. A, they need to be seen, and they're the kind of choreographers also, again, who develop the company. Then a dream of every dancer is pretty much to dance a Killian ballet. Another dream is to do works by William Forsythe. So naturally, I want to expose my dancers to that. We've been working with Mark Morris. We have sort of an official deal for 5 years. We have never written it down, that I will do a Mark Morris piece.
It's very exciting.
He's going to do something brand new for us, too. So, and why? Because Mark, again, develops the dancers. He's hyper-musical. His process of working is great. I was very privileged to work with Mark quite a bit, and I want my dancers to have the same opportunity. Because then, okay, then when we go to the Sleeping Beauty next time, you know what? They will do it better. It all helps the big process. At the same time, the career of a dancer is like a flight of a butterfly. The window is open and the window is closed. Those 20 years fly by. So I want them to have a really rich, profound experience because then when they move on, they can actually share that and continue to work for Terpsichore, because Terpsichore is going to be around much longer than any of us.
Can you talk about the rehearsal process?
Rehearsal process. Usually we work roughly 4 or 5 weeks for each production, each ballet. We have several different works under rehearsals at the same time. We're very privileged. We have a fantastic facility in Southend on 19 Clarendon with the 7 studios, really world-class facility. The main studio is probably the same size as this auditorium, so it's sort of pretty luxurious. And there are different ballets. The company utilizes most of the time around 4 studios, and they might be rehearsing right now. I still feed downstairs with a principal couple, Falling Angels in another studio, and group sections from Vasilvi in a big studio. So first the dancers learn the choreography, and then there's a little bit more different levels of detail coming in. Then we get into the run-through stage. Eventually we get the thing to the theater where we tech it. Basically just put the piece on the stage. It's already placed, they know exactly where to be. Then we add costumes and the lights, and yes, the orchestra. So it's like a step at a time.
So orchestra comes towards the end.
Yes, because those orchestra calls are real expensive. They do have their own calls where they rehearse, and then when they are sort of ready, then we put all this together. And in the meanwhile, the conductor has come into the rehearsals at a certain point, so he knows the tempi. So it's
so the dancers rehearse to the recorded music, or
we have pianists, live pianists, and once in a blue moon there's a piece that the choreographer really wants it to be done to the tape, or it cannot be produced by orchestra, so then we use the tape. But I find it that it has to have that live element, because at the end of everything, it's what you see visually on stage, and what is the emotions that come from the stage, what is the balance of the lighting, and what is the orchestra. Everything has to get to the same, let's say, same volume, same percentage. And when all those elements are lined up, that's when magic happens.
Does that rehearsal process change in any way when you're presenting a completely new piece? For example, does the choreographer stay with the dancers all the way through this process?
It does change, and you're so right. When it's a creation, it is a different process. It's much more intimate with the choreographer. Most of the choreographers really use the dancers as a sort of a, they get into the dancers and mold them and work with them. Very seldom somebody comes and says, oh, this, and it's like, let's try this, let's play with this and see how it works. And something works great, and then something really doesn't work, and then they try something else, and suddenly they find something that even the choreographer didn't think about before. So it's that kind of a process of being in a laboratory almost.
Which must be very exhilarating for the dancers, but also at times very frightening, because they don't know when they've reached the final version of a piece.
Yeah, and but that's where the trust comes. And some of these choreographers, they are fantastic because the dancers would jump off the cliff for them. I mean, the bond between the dancer and the choreographer, the trust, the choreographer cares about them. And I have to say, Jorma Elo is a really fun example of that.
So do you think when there is a new audience who has never seen ballet, let us say, is seeing ballet for the first time, that to an abstract ballet, there is no story to read in the program book. So let us say if it's a poetry, right, that you're reading, and then you can always go back to it and read because it's in printed form, or if you're watching a film, you can maybe rewind it or something. But in performing arts, the edge is also in the fact that it happens right then and there, and we make our story as artists then and there, and the audience see, the immediacy is there. So do you think that attracts more people, or it kind of makes people scared of it?
It can potentially do that. Therefore, whether it's a theater, opera, symphony concert, or ballet, I have found that it's very helpful that if you, somebody who knows the art form introduces it to you. Because if you have the right entry point, there's going to be a process. In the beginning, we liked something and then our tastes change. And it depending just what we're exposed to. And then, like personally, I remember, let's say, Balanchine's Violin Concerto. When I was 15, I saw it for the first time. In my early 20s, the ballet looked very different to me. And it has lived all through these different stages. I find different things about it interesting. And so then there's some of these works that they're relevant to you at the different points in your life. And naturally, the dancers, the interpreters have a lot to do with it. And different people bring different sides out of the pieces. So, but I think the key is just the right kind of introduction. But at the same time, I'm starting to wonder, maybe it doesn't have to be such a formula. Maybe today's young people, they can get into it a different way. So I don't think there's a one single way, but...
You obviously have to think like a teacher, both as the head of the company and as someone interested in creating new audiences for the future. This is not a trick question, it's a genuine one. If you were to choose a single ballet that you would use as your vehicle for introducing ballet to someone who had never been to the dance before, what would you choose? And really that question involves the difference between the appeal of a narrative ballet and the appeal of an abstract ballet.
I mean, in a way, it's really, that's a tough question, but immediately when I was listening to your question, the one ballet sort of popped into mind, and now I could speculate it for 2 hours and change my mind how many times, but let's say something like George Balanchine's Concerto Barocco that has a stunning score that is just a concert by itself. Visually, the quarter ballet movements are very architectural. Then there's these two solo girls that correspond to different instruments. And there's already sort of a poetry. It liberates. This ballet has sort of some of those elements, yet a little bit in a simple way, but so beautiful way that it's sort of heightened artistic experience. It almost becomes religious. It gets sort of Bach. And the choreography and the structure of the work, they are also so refined that people will most likely say, I could feel something. And I think if you're touched first, you're already way ahead.
My choice of a first opera would be The Magic Flute for some of the reasons that you've just been describing. Mm-hmm. It has a spiritual dimension to it and so many layers that audiences of different backgrounds and ages can attach themselves to different elements of the composition. Because Aparna is a celebrated Indian classical dancer, I wanted to ask you about non-Western audiences for Western ballet. Do you think about the future of ballet in Asia, for example, or the growing preponderance of Asians in Western mm-hmm. audiences?
Absolutely, and interestingly enough, I think there's a tremendous interest in Asia, more and more, and I hear about it, but I also see that there's an interest for the big international ballet companies to tour regions mm-hmm. like India and definitely Japan. They are really crazy about the ballet, which is great. And China's interest and, mm-hmm. you know, so I think that part of the world, and interestingly that India is one of the places that has, I feel there's almost like a dance boom happening. Mm-hmm. So more we can spread mm-hmm. the love of dance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is really universal, regardless of the form. Is it a modern, experimental, traditional Indian, or whatever, mm-hmm. the better we are, since art is really a food for the soul.
So which ballet would you present in India, for example?
You know,
your number one ballet.
And my number one ballet in India. You know, I would probably do same thing that we did. I did a tour of China, 5-week tour, 14 cities. We went to places that had not seen ballet of any kind. And we presented some segments from classical ballets. At the same time, we had a piece called Minor Threat by Mark Godden, which is very much like a Killian-esque work. And you should have experienced it because it was so quiet. People were just like... And besides the fact that I think the theater seated 1,400 people, and I heard there was 3,200 people.
Wow.
We could see the lights, and between the lights there were faces. It was really fascinating. And I'm sure they took something so fresh out of it. In the beginning, I'm sure they didn't know what to think, how to react. And at the end, they probably loved it even more than the other stuff.
I wanted to ask you finally a question about the relationship between different kinds of music and different kinds of dance. You spoke about Mark Morris and how musical he was, and I'm thinking in particular of his version of Dido and Aeneas, the Purcell opera. Have you seen that?
Yes.
Are you interested in making connections between dance and highly structured forms like opera?
You know, now that you ask, I have these almost crazy ideas. I would love the Boston Ballet to do a couple of Stravinsky operas. Rex Progress, Oedipus Rex, I think would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. I don't think whether it's ever going to come to that, mm-hmm. time will show. But definitely that kind of a cross-pollination is mm-hmm. super fascinating and interesting.
Mm-hmm. And returning music and theater to the multimedia element of Greek mm-hmm. theater, where, as you know, singing, dancing, and acting were all part of a total
yes.
artistic form.
Why not? Let's collaborate. Jagilab, with his ballet Rus, was an incredible engineer of putting artists from different genres,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Stravinsky, Picasso, Nijinsky, putting these personalities together. And the chemistry that happens in that kind of situation is so fantastic. And I think at one point in the middle of the 1900s, it started in Germany where they thought, all right, the choreographer of the theater should be the director, because they thought two salaries and one salary. And, you know, in a way, there was less putting really incredible artists next to each other. And I think a little bit through that process, some of the art got a little bit paler and lonelier for the individuals, and I would love to see that kind of thing to come back a little bit. I think we would all benefit.
Mm-hmm. Is there any aspect of your mission, your goals, that we haven't touched on in this conversation?
Maybe one thing that I take very seriously that guides lots of my actions on a daily basis is I'm very much trying to work in the long-term interest of this art form and this community. Sometimes I'm not looking at all for the big splash in the front end and very little delivery over the time. I rather create a little controversy in the beginning when I know that the long-term payoff is really big. So that's personally very important for me, and I'm willing to take the heat. I don't have to go away from that, but I also see more you behave from that kind of philosophical foundation, you don't have to deal with that. It just clicks into the place.
You've made me rethink Walter Pater's famous statement that all art aspires to the condition of music. We could also say all art aspires to the condition of dance. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Pleasure. So,
questions?
Yeah.
We're happy to take questions from the floor if anyone would like to ask questions.
Anybody? Who wants to be the first brave one?
I read recently that the ABT has started a fund for their costume restoration and conditioning and so forth. Does Boston Ballet have the same problem as maybe the ABT does? And do they have a fund or an idea for something like that to keep the costumes going?
Well, we have to always invest into the, let's say that we have physical productions of Romeo and Juliet, Swan Lake. The company utilizes those costumes when we perform, but we also rent them from other companies. There's wear and tear, and we have to invest a little bit money to keep the productions up and looking good. We don't have a specific fund, but there's many ways to raise money for the company, and creating these kind of funds specifically targeted for the people, and then finding the people who has interest in that together with the art form is a good way to make sort of a two-way street. So we don't have that specifically, but of course we take care of that very much in terms of the, it is important how the things are visually presented.
I'm very interested in the relationship between the dancer and the choreographer, because it seems to me that that in Diaghilev's ballets, often the dancer was the choreographer, and of course Balanchine was a dancer. Do you, for example, work with your dancers? Do the dancers work out the choreography with you?
Let's say in the Diaghilev's days, there was Massin, who was a resident choreographer for the Ballet Russe, and he was a dancer. Nijinsky was the same. But earlier, Petipas, and later days, Fokin, they stopped dancing and they kept choreographing. It's usually, they're a little bit two different things, and way too often actually it's not a great thing to be both. At the same time, I don't consider myself a choreographer. I know the classical ballets inside out, I can stage them, and yes, there's a creative choreographic process, but I'm not creating a new scenarios, new concepts, and inventing a new movement vocabulary, because that's what I really believe being a choreographer means. I think it's fascinating, and that would be one of the most exciting things to do in life. But in order to do that, I would want to devote 24 hours every day of my life to it. And I have chosen, I weighed my assessment of my talents, and I thought, you know, running a company and trying to do the service for the art form through that was my calling. So it's the relationship is interesting, You pretty much have to be a dancer that you can really choreograph, because otherwise the process can be a mess. But who am I to say? Right now, I know there's a couple people who are doing choreography that don't have the true understanding of the vocabulary, but they are somehow really fresh in how to put these impressions and these artistic things, and yes, they're utilizing dancers. So that is happening in today's art, but not too much in a really sort of a mainstream.
You had training in the St. Petersburg.
Yes.
And I'm sure that you know very well the name of Leonid Jacobson. Do you have any plans to recreate something of his ballets? I'm sure that all Russian community will be in your
yes.
audience.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, Leonid Jacobson's contribution to the art form and especially to the heritage of the Russian ballet was so tremendous, and he was suppressed under the Soviet regime, and he was collaborating so much with the finest artists in Russia, including Shostakovich. They were really close personal friends. I have been blessed and lucky. I am a very close friend with Irina Jacobson, who was Leonid Jacobson's wife. And I even had plans when I restaged Swan Lake last year to have Irina Jacobson to be my right hand in the process. It didn't work out. Unfortunately, I would love to see a couple of the Jacobson miniatures come into the repertoire. And unfortunately, I was playing with one of the ideas for the next year, and it didn't, but hopefully soon.
When you gave us your list of the four classical ballets we could expect to see in their turn year after year, I noticed a striking exception. May we expect another 100 years of the Nutcracker?
Well, we are in America, and Nutcracker is given. Pretty much it has come into the American Christmas tradition. For me, Nutcracker is one of those cornerstone classical ballets. Part of the success of the Nutcracker relies on this incredible score by Tchaikovsky. The story is a profound story. Children and adults alike can relate to it. My job is to keep Nutcracker fresh. We just created a new version for the Colonial Theater this year, a smaller venue where we were performing this year because of the misplacement from our current home, Wang Center. And I felt that I didn't want to try to take a production we had and squeeze it in. We'd tailor make a brand new production a little bit more with today's means, and I had an opportunity to do something that I probably wanted to do, but because of the magnitude and importance of the Nutcracker, I probably would have never had the guts to try to say, all right, let's put the Nutcracker aside, because every ballet company in North America is so relying on certain revenue that Nutcracker produces. There would be half of the ballet companies from about 15 dancers to the largest companies would not exist in North America if there would be no Nutcracker. The government funding, the national endowments of the arts, the state and city funding on such levels that it wouldn't make the equation. With the money that ballet companies make in Nutcracker, they're able to present some of the works that actually they don't make money, they lose money, but are important for the art and for the art form.
Apparently some young choreographers stage ballet for the movies, essentially. Not necessarily the movies, but they make a film out of it, and those films are shown in special festivals. Is that a common thing to do? Is it just the first stage before they become known, or is it, from your perspective, a new art form in some sense?
I would think that that's not the mainstream. I know there are lots of people who are experimenting in that, and I think can be very interesting and fascinating. In a way, it is another art form. And we were speaking right before this talk about the fact that when dance is filmed, it's like two art forms merging and creating something else. Because if you just document and shoot a dance production from the same perspective as the audience sees it, usually the end result is lukewarm. Therefore, I would like to see dance shot specifically almost as a new art form. I hope I answered your question somewhat.
Hi, I had a question for the two of you. I'm interested in, could there be like a fusion of Indian classical and ballet? Because that would be really cool to see as well, so.
Maybe, yes.
There's Chakra Khan. Mm-hmm. In Europe, uh-huh. is utilizing elements of classical Indian dance and some kind of acrobatics and ballet and making an incredibly interesting fusion of it. And I believe the company even performed in New York mm-hmm. about a year and a half ago. So it is, and it is happening more and more. If you look at where certain popular music, ambient music is going in France, all this Buddha Bar era, and there's so much of the Oriental music part of that mixed. I think today the cultures are, they're really finding these new formats, and usually they contribute a lot, sometimes enhance and enrichen it profoundly.
Mm-hmm. And also, even long time ago, Uday Shankar used a lot of ballet techniques within his choreography in India, and also, I mean, just the piece you were doing now, I mean, I could see a lot of the positions had such commonalities between the Indian classical dance and what the dancers were doing now, even the footwork. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, all dance can be connected in some ways, like human beings could be.
Maybe two more questions.
Hey, does the Boston Ballet collaborate regularly with students from the Boston area or beyond in terms of music and choreography?
I'm aware of the larger dance community. Currently, we haven't done yet any musical collaborations. I'm very interested in that. And naturally, there's a Matthew Neenan who is doing choreography mainly in Pittsburgh for Pennsylvania Ballet, who's local choreographer from here. I'm very open to that. The only thing is, I would say most likely the process would be that I get find a choreographer that I can see eventually doing a work for the company, and I would direct them to Boston Ballet to do something work and tell exactly and expose them to the company at the same time, because luckily the repertoire is of very high international standard, and you know the mushrooms, they grow. You can find really talented choreographer, but you have to give it the right time and expose it at the right way. So I would be much more interested of finding the local talent, help them to develop, and then at the right point when their product is right for us, then we can highlight them in that way.
When you have a good solid ballet company and then out of it suddenly a real star emerges, someone who's going to be just an enormous star in his own or her own generation, how do you integrate that and him or her into the company? Do you really choose ballets that will star them, and what does other company feel about a great star in their midst?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. Either you want to make a company that has couple stars, or you make a company that everybody is a great dancer. But you know, occasionally someone's talent is so bright that they sort of single themselves out. At that kind of a situation, you have to create an environment that nourishes and allows them to grow. But at the same time, you have to also let them free a little bit. So you work with each artist in that way, and it's wonderful. I have some dancers that I'm sometimes totally at awe, and they bring some things that will be very hard to bring through coaching. So it's this collaboration of guidance and allowing them, and yet at the same time we have to remind that this is the address where we all want to end up, mm-hmm. But they really enrich the process. It's a little bit like somebody says, wow, this Alexander Pushkin was such a fantastic teacher. Look at, he trained Mikhail Brezhnikov and Rudolf Nureyev and generations of fantastic male dancers. Brezhnikov would have been a great dancer, probably, if your next door neighbor would have taught him. So there's a certain... Why am I saying this? I'm saying that sometimes the fountain of talent is so tremendous, it will push through and it will find its way. When you're working with the artist of that kind of a caliber, you cannot mess with the process. You can help and guide. You can give them a good foundation in a ballet training, in your daily classes. You can expose them to great choreographers and then commission a world premieres from those choreographers and let them fly with the individual.
I was once on an academic platform with Marcel Marceau, the great French mime, and when he was presented with his diploma, he said nothing but mimed his gratitude. Were I Marcel Marceau, I would mime my gratitude to you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a discussion with Boston Ballet Artistic Director Mikko Niissanen. Leading tonight's discussion was Professor Bruce Redford, Director of the University Professors Program, and Aparno Sandhor, Artistic Director of Navarasa Dance Theater. We began with a greeting from Vita Palladino, Managing Director of the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.